Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. In today's episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts, we're going to begin to review autonomic pharmacology. It's super, super high yield for step one, for step two CK, I'll almost imagine step three. And I'm also pretty sure it's something that you'll encounter pretty frequently on the wards. So it's just one of those things you want to get down. And if you're also doing an anesthesia rotation, this will also be a useful topic. And because of the volume of material involved, I'm not going to talk about everything in this one podcast. I'll probably break them up into like two or three podcasts to make sure that we really get this down well. In fact, today's goal is primarily to go over autonomic physiology. And then I'll begin to introduce the drugs that act on the alpha adrenergic system. And then we'll take off from the other drugs with other podcasts. So let's begin. So we know that the nervous system, right, there is at least for the efferent nervous system, if you may, we have a somatic system and an autonomic system. The somatic system, we know that to be a one neuron system. Okay, and it's actually under voluntary control. And basically, the way the system works is it sort of starts in the motor cortex, okay, the precentral gyrus, okay, and then it comes down as the corticospinal tract, which decussates at the level of the medullary pyramids. And then those fibers continue onto the ventral horn of the spinal cord, okay, remember the ventral horn is anterior, and that's where alpha motor neurons begin. Okay, and then those alpha motor neurons then continue and then synapse on skeletal muscle. And they actually release acetylcholine that acts on the nicotinic receptor, the NM, M as in MOBI or whatever, okay? The NM nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, okay? And please do not confuse these NM receptors with the NN, so N as in Nancy, NN receptors that you find at on the cell membranes of the postganglionic neurons in the autonomic nervous system. Okay. Now, just some high-yield integration pathology here. A classic board question is one that involves spinal muscular atrophy. It's also known as a Werdnig-Hoffmann disease. Okay, it's an autosomal recessive disease where you basically destroy neurons in the ventral horn of the spinal cord. I remember the pathophysiology involves a mutation in the survival motor neuron 1 gene on chromosome 5. Okay, it's an autosomal recessive disease. The classic description is a baby that is not meeting motor milestones. And this baby is almost always like 6-7 months on exams. And the baby will have tongue fasciculations. Okay, if you see a baby with tongue fasciculations, you should have a very good reason to not pick spinal muscular atrophy. And just as an aside, if you saw tongue fasciculations in a person that is older, like an older patient, think more about ALS, okay, Lou Gehrig's disease. And don't forget that West Nile virus and poliovirus can also kill alpha motor neurons. Okay, so now we've talked about the somatic nervous system, let's talk about the autonomic nervous system, okay? The somatic nervous system, we said, was a one-neuron system. The autonomic nervous system is a two-neuron system, okay? And it includes the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. Now, the sympathetic nervous system, it's called the thoracolumbar system because it runs from T1 to L2, okay? It basically originates in the lateral horn of the thoracic spinal cord. Okay, and the thing is, the ganglia that relate to the sympathetic nervous system, they are very close to the vertebral bodies. In fact, they are classically known as the paravertebral ganglia. Okay, so if the ganglia that contains the cell bodies of the postganglionic neurons are close to the vertebral bodies, that should tell you that the neurons that lead to them, or the preganglionic neurons, have to be short. Okay, so the sympathetic nervous system has short preganglionic neurons and long postganglionic neurons because those neurons have to travel all the way from the ganglia that are juxtaposed to the spinal cord, and then they have to travel all the way to the organs of interest. Okay, now, in general, at the preganglionic neuron, the short preganglionic neuron, you release acetylcholine that acts on the NN nicotinic receptors on the postganglionic neurons. Okay, and then the postganglionic neurons release norepinephrine, not epinephrine. Epinephrine is not what is released at these synapses. I'll talk about epinephrine in a bit. But the thing you actually release is norepinephrine. So norepinephrine is released from the long postganglionic neurons, okay, and it acts on adrenergic receptors. Although that is not always true, the sympathetic nervous system has two other derivatives, right? So in your sweat glands, for example, right? So if your sweat gland is a target organ, the postganglionic neurons in the sympathetic nervous system actually release acetylcholine, okay, which acts on muscarinic receptors. That is why sweating is one of the antecedents that are observed in the setting of cholinergic overactivation. So you release acetylcholine, act on muscarinic receptors and the target organs, sympathetic nervous system for the sweat glands, okay? It's not always adrenergic receptors. Alternatively, the postganglionic neurons in the sympathetic nervous system can also release dopamine, okay? Dopamine acts on different kinds of receptors at different doses, right? So at low doses, it acts on dopamine D1 and 2 receptors. At medium doses, it acts on the beta receptors, right? So beta 1 and 2. And then at high doses, it acts on alpha 1 and 2 receptors, okay? Easy way to remember that is you're going from low to high, okay? And then you're going from a later alphabet to an earlier alphabet, from D to B to A. Now, for the parasympathetic nervous system, think of it as being the craniosacral system. It's called craniosacral because it originates with the cranial nerves, 3, right? Oculomotor nerve, 7, that's the facial nerve, 9, that's the glossopharyngeal nerve, and 10, that's the vagus nerve, okay? And it goes with S2 to 4. And remember that the vagus nerve, its innervation ends at the left colic flexure, right? Also known as the splenic flexure. Now, in the parasympathetic system, the ganglia that contain the cell bodies of the postganglionic neurons, okay, they actually lie in the walls of the target organs, okay? So that should tell you that, oh, if the initial fibers have to get to the walls of those organs, those preganglionic neurons have to be long, okay? So in your parasympathetic system, you have long preganglionic neurons and short postganglionic neurons, okay? So an example of a parasympathetic nerve ganglia is your Aubach's and Meissner's plexi in your GI tracts, okay? Those are examples of ganglia, right? So again, they would need long preganglionic neurons to sort of feed them. And the thing is, the long preganglionics, they release acetylcholine that again acts on NN nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, okay, on the surface of the short postganglionic neuron. And just as a general principle, just remember that in the autonomic nervous system, the preganglionic neurons, regardless of where they come from, be it sympathetic or parasympathetic, always release acetylcholine that acts on nicotinic receptors. So, and then in the parasympathetic system, the short postganglionic neurons, they release acetylcholine that then acts on muscarinic receptors, okay? Now, a quick word on dopamine, right? So dopamine, we said that it can be released by postganglionic neurons in the sympathetic nervous system, okay? One classically tested exam factoid relating to dopamine is that there are receptors on the afferent arteriole of the nephron, okay? And the thing is, when dopamine acts on those receptors, it actually causes a dilation of the afferent arteriole, okay, to increase renal perfusion. Okay, so there's a drug that performs this, is known as phenyldopam. Okay, it's a dopamine receptor agonist. You basically give it at like low doses in the setting of shock, so you can activate dopamine receptors in the afferent arteriole and increase renal perfusion. Okay, but one thing you should think about is that, yes, this is theoretically true, but so it's supposed to like protect the kidneys because it's increasing renal perfusion in the setting of shock. That's a theoretical truism, but it's not been proven in many studies. In fact, I will say in general, in the ICU literature, this has largely been discredited. So I'm just mentioning this for the purposes of, oh, if it shows up on in your world or on a step one exam, you're not fazed by this. But it's largely been disproven by many studies, but it's just something to keep in mind. Now, another special mention here is with the adrenal medulla, okay? So remember, the adrenal gland contains a cortex and a medulla. The cortex has the glomerulosa that secretes aldosterone or mineralocorticoids. The cortex also has the zona fasciculata that secretes glucocorticoids, and then the zona reticularis that secretes sex steroids, okay? But there's also a medulla to the adrenal gland that contains cells known as chromaffin cells, and it's super high yield for your exam to know that those cells are derived from neurocrest. Okay, now these chromaffin cells are actually a modified kind of postganglionic sympathetic neuron. Okay, So, if they're a modified kind of postganglionic sympathetic neuron, it should then make some sense that these fibers have nicotinic acetylcholine receptors on their surfaces. That's a very high yield factoid you want to know for your exam. And these cells, instead of releasing norepinephrine, they do in fact release epinephrine. Okay, the reason that they release epinephrine is that the adrenal medulla expresses an enzyme known as PNMT. Okay, PNMT converts norepinephrine to epinephrine. Okay, so because the adrenal medulla is like basically the only high yield part of the body that expresses this enzyme, that's why you make epinephrine specifically in the adrenal medulla. And some quick things about PNMT. PNMT actually depends on SAM, S-adenosylmethionine, as a cofactor, okay? Because the big difference between norepinephrine and epinephrine is actually a methyl group, okay? And we know that SAM is a methyl carrier, okay? So I just decided to include that as a nice biochem tie-in for you there. Another thing about PNMT is it's actually activated by cortisol. So this is one of the ways cortisol has a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system. That's why patients get hypotensive when they have some kind of steroid crisis, right? Where they have like an adrenal insufficiency. Now, one high yield integration with this is, let's assume you get an exam question about a person that has Crohn's or some kind of autoimmune disease where they've had to take steroids chronically, okay? And then they tell you that, oh, this person goes in for surgery, or they have like they're septic, like they have like a really bad sickness, and then they become profoundly hypotensive, and they say you keep giving these people pressors, you give them IV fluids, and they are not responsive, like their blood pressures are not rising. Think about administering a stress dose of steroids, okay? Because remember, cortisol is a stress hormone, and if you undergo stressful events, like say for example you're taking step one, you probably need a little more cortisol than normal, right? So if those people have been taking exogenous glucocorticoids and their HPA axis, right, so the adrenal axis has been suppressed chronically, those people in the setting of extra stress, they can make extra cortisol or whatever to keep their bodies going, okay? So those people require higher than normal doses of steroids to tidy them over those stress periods, if you may. So just something to keep in mind. Now, so now we've mentioned that, let's talk about ion channels, okay? Ion channels. So ion channels, there are two kinds, okay? And those two kinds are differentiated by what gets those ion channels going. So there are ion channels that are voltage gated, right? So a change in the membrane properties of a cell is what activates those ion channels. An example of the voltage gated ion channel is a voltage gated calcium channel that exists on presynaptic neurons, okay? So when an action potential travels down a neuron, it causes a depolarization. When the membrane voltage changes, then those calcium channels are activated, okay? And then calcium can come in and cause the exocytosis of neurotransmitter from vesicles. That's an example of a voltage-gated ion channel. And it's very high yield to know that that voltage-gated calcium channel that is found on presynaptic neurons can be attacked by autoantibodies with a disease known as Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. It's a relatively common, or I guess a commonly tested exam factoid relating to small cell lung cancer as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. And then the second kind of ion channel is a ligand-gated ion channel. Okay, so the nicotinic receptor, right, where acetylcholine acts on, is actually a ligand-gated ion channel, right? So when acetylcholine binds to that channel, it increases its permeability to sodium, okay? So that then causes sodium to rush into a skeletal muscle, for example, and causes the skeletal muscle to fire, okay? So that's an example of a ligand-gated ion channel. It's not changes in membrane voltage that activate it. It's the binding of a ligand. And those nicotinic receptors are actually the ones that are blocked by neuromuscular blocking agents, okay? Now, the second kind of receptor that is necessary for our autonomic discussion are the G-protein coupled receptors, okay? And the G-protein coupled receptors, there's three types. There's the GQs, we'll talk about those in a bit. There's the GSs and there's the GIs, okay? And in general, you want to know the different receptors that fall under these three categories. Well, thankfully, there's a very nice mnemonic that can help you accomplish that. So, the GQ coupled receptors, basically the way these work is when a ligand binds to them, okay, you have an activation of phospholipase C. phospholipase C can convert phosphoinositol bisphosphate, PIP2, to IP3. Okay, PIP2 is actually a lipid. Okay, it's found in cell membranes. Okay, so it converts PIP2. So phospholipase C converts PIP2 to IP3, inositol triphosphate, which actually increases the release of calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum. Or I guess if you're thinking about skeletal muscle, it will be the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, and then the other derivative of PIP2 under the action of phospholipase C is DAG, diacylglycerol. Okay, diacylglycerol is something that activates protein kinase C that has some things that have to do with muscle mechanics. We'll talk about that in a later podcast. Now, the receptors that work through a GQ system, okay, the good mnemonic that you'll learn as you're studying for step one is cutesies have one M&M. Okay, so cutesies have one M&M. So what does the have one M&M stand for? Or the cutesy, right? So the cutesy tells you like a Q and a C. So GQ uses phospholipase C and involves protein kinase C. Okay, and then the have, don't worry about the E, just worry about the HAV. And the one M&M just tells you that the histamine H1 receptor, the alpha 1 receptor, the vasopressin V1 receptor, the M1 and 3 muscarinic receptors all work through the GQ system. Okay, now the next system are the GI systems. Okay, basically GI, if a ligand binds to that receptor, you have an inhibition of adenylate cyclase. Okay, and remember, adenylate cyclase's job is to convert ATP to cyclic AMP. So if you inhibit adenylate cyclase, you have less level, you have a reduced levels of cyclic AMP, and you basically have reduced levels of high-yield second messenger, so many operations during the cell are either turned off or something, okay? So the receptors that use the GI-coupled system, an easy way to remember them is the MAT2s, okay? So the muscarinic M2 receptor, the alpha-2 receptor, and the D2 receptor. Those are the things that work with the GI-coupled system. And then, basically, if you remember the GQ mnemonic and the GI mnemonic, you basically take whatever autonomic receptors you know beyond what I just mentioned, plus the histamine and vasopressin receptors, and those are the ones that function under the GS coupled system. Okay, and the GS coupled system, when a ligand binds, you activate adenylate cyclase, you convert ATP to cyclic AMP, and then cyclic AMP can go ahead and activate protein kinase A. You see many of those signaling cascades in biochemistry. Okay, so now let's talk about the autonomic receptors, okay? And for this podcast, we'll just focus on the adrenergic receptors, okay? So the thing is, there are many, many functions of these receptors, but I will say if you know the functions I'm describing now, you're probably good to go on the receptors. So alpha 1 receptors, okay, you generally find them on smooth muscle. Okay, you find them in many other places, but for purposes of this discussion, let's just talk about them as being on smooth muscle. Okay, and the thing is, when you activate these receptors on the smooth muscle of blood vessels, you cause a vasoconstriction. Okay, that's one high yield function to know. Another high yield function to know is when you activate these receptors in the eyes, okay, you have mydriasis, right? So that's pupillary dilation. Another thing is when you activate these receptors on the bladder neck, okay, like the urinary sphincter, you get a constriction of the urinary sphincter and you basically have urinary retention because the pee is not going anywhere, okay? So high yield functions for the alpha 1 receptors, okay? Activate on blood vessels, you get vasoconstriction. Activate in the eyes, you get mydriasis, that's pupillary dilation. Activate on the bladder neck, you get constriction of the urinary sphincter and urinary retention. Okay, that is all you probably need to know about alpha 1 receptors. Now, alpha 2 receptors, right? So they are GI coupled, okay? So it's an inhibitory system. I sort of think of these as a negative feedback system for the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, so when you activate them, you basically decrease the release of norepinephrine. Okay, so activation of these receptors prevents the release of norepinephrine from the presynaptic neuron. Okay, so that's all you probably need to know about alpha 2. Now let's jump to beta 1. Okay, beta 1 receptors, you find them largely on the heart and the afferent arteriole. Okay, when you activate these receptors on the heart, you increase heart rate, right? So a positive chronotropic effect. You increase contractility, that's a positive inotropic effect. And you also increase the speed of conduction through the AV node. Okay, I'm just giving you the functions here. If you learn these functions, then it's the drug information is much easier to remember. Okay, much easier to remember. Now, when you also activate the beta 1 receptors on the juxtaglomerular cells at the afferent arterial, you also increase the release of renin, okay, which kickstarts the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. Now, for beta 2 receptors, you can think of the beta 2 receptors as being a dilating receptor, if you may. Okay, the high yield functions you want to know is if you activate this receptor in the airway, okay, you cause bronchodilation. Okay, so that's a dilatory effect. If you activate these receptors in blood vessels, you get vasodilation. Again, that's another dilatory effect. Because basically the beta 2 receptors, they work through a GS coupled system. They increase your levels of cyclic AMP. And one principle I guess you can sort of commit to memory at this point is high levels of cyclic AMP in smooth muscle, not skeletal or cardiac, in smooth muscle causes relaxation. Okay, you'll see many applications of these principles in our multiple podcasts. But when you activate beta 2 receptors, GS coupled system, you cause smooth muscle relaxation. So in the airway, you can get bronchodilation. In your blood vessels, you can get vasodilation. In the uterus, the smooth muscle that makes up the myometrium, you actually get a relaxation as well. Okay, that's why tocolytics, drugs like ritodrine and terbutaline, which are beta 2 agonists, can be used to delay labor by causing relaxation of the smooth muscle that constitutes the myometrium. So again, just real quick, because this is super, super high yield. Alpha 1 receptors, three high yield functions. Activate them on smooth muscle or vessels, you get vasoconstriction in the eyes, mydriasis or pupillary dilation, in the bladder, contraction of the urinary sphincter, so you retain urine. For alpha 2 receptors, you activate them, you decrease the release of norepinephrine in the sympathetic nervous system. For beta 1 receptors, you activate them in the heart, okay? You increase heart rate, contractility, and speed of conduction through the AV node. In the GG cells that constitute the afferent arterial, you increase the release of renin. For beta 2 receptors, okay, when you activate them in the airway, you get bronchodilation. In blood vessels, you get vasodilation. Smooth muscle of the myometrium, you get relaxation of the uterus, okay? So they are tocolytics. Okay. So, and I will say more about these receptors in future podcasts, especially as we talk about our different systems, okay? So, let's talk about some drugs that act on alpha-1, the alpha-1 system, okay? So, let's talk about the agonists first, and then we'll talk about the antagonists. And the thing is, I won't just straight up give you drug names. I will give you the ways this information is classically tested on exams, right? So, the alpha-1 agonist, the first one we'll talk about are pseudoephedrine and ephedrine, okay? Again, like I said, they are alpha-1 receptor agonists, okay? And they are primarily used to treat hypotension, right? So, if, for example, they give you a question about a person that gets an IV anesthetic, like a propofol, for example, and then the person becomes hypotensive, in general, the answer choice you want to pick on the exam as a reversal agent of the hypotension, if you may, is an alpha-1 agonist like pseudoephedrine or ephedrine, okay? Very commonly used in the world of anesthesia. You can also use these drugs as nasal decongestants, right? Because again, by activating those alpha-1 receptors, you vasoconstrict the vessels that feed the nose, okay? So you're sending, there's less blood flow to the nose, so the nasty goopy stuff that makes up your mucus, because remember, mucus is sort of kind of an ultrafiltrate of blood, if you may, although it includes some other stuff, but we're not going to get into those details. This is not an immunology podcast, but by decreasing blood flow to the nose, you're making less mucus, okay? So you're exerting a nasal decongestive effect. Okay, now that we're talking about this, you can actually make some pathological integration here with cocaine, okay? The thing is, cocaine prevents the reuptake of norepinephrine, okay, at the adrenergic synapse, so you have higher levels of norepinephrine. So the thing is, if you keep using cocaine chronically and you have very high levels of catecholamines like norepinephrine, and you get vasoconstriction of the vessels that feed the nose, okay, you can get nasal ischemia, and your nasal septum can actually perforate, okay? In fact, that's a common exam question relating to cocaine, okay? That's one of the mechanisms behind that, nasal ischemia from alpha-1 mediated vasoconstriction. Okay, and just as an aside, if a person is intoxicated with cocaine, do you want to give them a beta blocker on an exam? I really hope you're saying no, okay? Because by doing that, remember that beta 2 receptors cause vasodilation, okay? So if you gave a beta blocker, right, you block beta 1 and 2 receptors. You're basically blocking the vasodilatory effect of beta 2 receptors. So you have unopposed alpha 1 activation, which can cause vasoconstriction, cause a nasty hypertension, and the person's blood pressure can even rise higher. Okay, so cocaine overdose, never, or cocaine intoxication, I guess. Never give a beta blocker, okay? The first line treatment on your exam is actually a benzodiazepine, okay? So you give a benzo for the treatment of cocaine intoxication. So now we've talked about the alpha-1 agonists, let's talk about the alpha-1 antagonists, okay? The alpha-1 antagonists, it's best to think of them as being either reversible alpha-1 blockers or irreversible alpha-1 blockers, okay? And then we'll talk about some special alpha-1 blockers in a bit relating to BPH, okay? So the reversible alpha-1 blockers, they can easily test this in the context of Michaelis-Menten kinetics, okay? So because they are reversible, okay, if you're thinking in terms of Michaelis-Menten kinetics, your Vmax should not change, okay? But your Km should increase because you're having less affinity of a regular agonist for that receptor, okay? The drug here is a phentolamine. Okay, now for the irreversible alpha-1 antagonist, the drug you want to think about is phenoxybenzamine. And if you're thinking about this again in the context of Michaelis-Menten kinetics, your Vmax should decrease because you're taking actual enzyme out of commission, but your Km should stay the same. Okay, your Km should stay the same. Now, an integration of this with pathology is with a pheochromocytoma. Remember, this is a tumor that secretes catecholamines. It has a classic association with the MEN syndromes, okay? It also has an association with neurofibromatosis type 1, okay? So just something to keep in mind. So a pheochromocytoma, the classic presentation is episodic headache and hypertension, okay? Now, if you want to do surgery, right, to remove the mass, okay? The thing is, as you're doing that surgery, if the mass explodes or catecholamine leaks from the mass, you can have very, very nasty hypertension and the person can, like, die. So, in general, before those people go for surgery, you pre-treat them. So how do you pre-treat them? You give them some adrenergic agents, okay? Actually, multiple adrenergic agents. But the multiple adrenergic agents you give them has to be given a specific order, okay? And this specific order is the meat you want to know for your exam. The thing is, in general, you want to block alpha-1 receptors first, okay? And then you block beta receptors, okay? The reason you want to block alpha-1 receptors first is that, again, you want to take that alpha-1-mediated vasoconstriction out of commission before you then go after the beta receptors, okay? The reason you still block the beta receptors is, remember that catecholamines can act on beta-1 receptors and severely increase your heart rate and contractility, okay? So you block alpha-1 receptors first, and then you block beta receptors, okay? So again, you block alpha-1 receptors first because you want to avoid hypertension, okay? And then you block beta-1 receptors to decrease the super increased cardiac output you can get with super activation of beta-1 receptors on myocardium. And you can actually use phentolamine or phenoxybenzamine for the alpha blockade, okay, in the treatment of a FIA. Now, another integration with these alpha-1 blockers is with BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, right? So, obviously, it won't be a 30-year-old that presents with this on an exam, right? It'll be like a 70-year-old guy, has trouble urinating, has urinary dribbling, whatever. And remember I said that alpha-1 receptors, you find them at the urinary sphincter, at the bladder neck. If you activate them, you cause constriction of that sphincter and urinary retention. So, if a person has BPH, you want to block those alpha-1 receptors, right? Because now open up that urinary sphincter and it can give a temporary relief of their symptoms, right? So they can pee better, okay? So the drugs you can give here that alpha-1 blockers include drugs like, they're your Zosyn drugs, okay? So drugs like Prazosyn, Doxazosyn, Terazosyn, they are all drugs that can open up that bladder neck. Another drug you could give is Tamsulosyn, okay? And this is why Tamsulosyn is actually high yield to know, apart from those other three. The thing is, it specifically blocks the alpha-1AD receptors, which you find at the bladder neck, but you do not find in blood vessels. Because the thing is, if a person has BPH, yes, you give them like Prazosyn, for example. Yes, you are opening up the bladder neck, but you're actually also blocking alpha-1 receptors in their blood vessels. So those people could get hypotensive, Okay, they could get like an orthostatic hypotension, if you may, from that. So if you just wanted to be more specific for the bladder, you could give tamsulosin. Tamsulosin blocks the alpha-1 isoform, the alpha-1 AD subtype that is found specifically at the bladder neck. Okay, but if a person had BPH and hypertension on your exam, giving them a drug like prazosin, doxazosin, or terazosin are all very good options. Okay. Now, one other thing I will say is, for BPH, you should be able to contrast the difference between giving a drug for the immediate relief of symptoms with a drug for the long-term relief of symptoms, okay? So, for immediate relief of symptoms on your exam, you want to give an alpha-1 blocker, okay? But for long-term treatment of BPH, okay, you want to give a different kind of medication. So here's the reasoning here. The thing is, dihydrotestosterone, DHT, okay, encourages the growth of the prostate, okay? So if you wanted to prevent a person's prostate from growing, or basically wanted like the prostate to like atrophy, if you may, and shrink, one thing you can do is to try to pharmacologically lower a person's levels of DHT. The thing is, DHT comes from testosterone. The enzyme that makes that conversion is 5-alpha reductase, okay? So you could already predict that you could give a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor like finasteride or dutasteride to inhibit 5-alpha reductase, make less dihydrotestosterone, and effectively decrease the production of DHT, and that can actually shrink the size of the prostate. Okay, it's used as long-term treatment for BPH. Okay, so just something high yield to know there. Now, another quick thing is these alpha-1 blockers, right? Again, if you notice, I'm not just giving you drug names here. I'm just trying to tell you, okay, this is the way they'll test this. This is the way they'll test that. Okay, the thing is, alpha-1 blockade causes dilation of your blood vessels, right? So you get vasodilation, so you could get orthostatic hypotension from that. Now, the thing is, one common, I guess, physiology they test on exams, pharmacology they test on exams, are drug interactions between drugs that have vasodilatory effects, right? So one thing they could do is they could give you a patient, they give you their drug history, and they already take one medication that's a peripheral vasodilator, and then they say which of the following like medications are contraindicated, right? Because the thing is, we know that peripheral vasodilators cause orthostatic hypotension. So if you combined that with another peripheral vasodilator, you could cause profound hypotension that can cause like a syncopal episode. Okay, so you want to avoid that. So the classic drugs you don't want to combine with an alpha-1 blocker on exams, okay, include drugs like your phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors, like a sildenafil, tadalafil, right? So remember sildenafil, that's Viagra. In fact, if you pay attention to the Viagra ads, you'll see that they say, Viagra should not be taken in a person that also takes nitrates to prevent an unsafe drop in blood pressure, right? So they include that warning because nitrates are also vasodilators. Okay, remember your PDE5 inhibitors, use them for pulmonary hypertension, but you can also use them for erectile dysfunction. Okay, now you also want to avoid alpha-1 blockers with hydralazine. Okay, quick word on hydralazine, right? So hydralazine is a vasodilator, right? That's why you don't combine it with an alpha-1 blocker. But one other commonly tested factoid with hydralazine is that its mechanism is that it dilates precapillary arterioles. Okay, so remember, right, your arteries, they become arterioles, and then those arterioles form capillaries, and then those capillaries form venules. Okay, hydralazine works by dilating precapillary arterioles. And think about it, if you dilate a precapillary arterial, you're increasing blood flow to capillaries, okay? And if you increase blood flow to capillaries, you're increasing, if you're thinking in terms of your Starling forces, you're increasing the hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries, and that can increase the extravasation of fluid. That's why you could classically get edema as a side effect with hydralazine, okay? Because you're increasing hydrostatic pressures in capillaries. So if we know that increasing the hydrostatic pressures in capillaries is the mechanism behind edema with hydralazine, we can try to counter that effect by dilating the post-capillary venules, right? So if you dilate the venules that drain the capillaries, you will decrease the hydrostatic pressure and you will directly act against the pathophysiology of the edema, right? So the classic high-yield post-capillary venule dilator you want to know for your exam are the ACE inhibitors. Okay, your ACE inhibitors, they can dilate those post-capillary venules and treat the edema that's associated with hydralazine. As you'll see, this edema from dilation of precapillary arterioles is another high-yield side effect with your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, like amlodipine, felodipine, and stuff like that. Okay, so hydralazine, that's one high yield factoid you want to know. Another high yield hydralazine factoid is that it's safe in pregnancy. Okay, so you can use it to treat hypertension in pregnancy. The other drugs that are safe in hypertension in pregnancy, the mnemonic for those is hypertensive moms love nifedipine. Okay, so the H stands for hydralazine, the M stands for methyl DOPA, okay, the L stands for labetalol, okay, and the N stands for nifedipine, okay, so something to keep in mind there. Another high yield factor with hydralazine is that it can actually cause drug-induced lupus, okay, remember the association there with antihistone antibodies. In general, if you stop the drug, the lupus would go away. And one weird factor to just sort of keep in mind is patients that have drug-induced lupus, they tend to be slow acetylators, okay? Slow acetylators. So just sort of keep that in mind. They usually test that factoid in the context of isoniazid. So again, avoid an alpha-1 blocker with hydralazine. Another drug you want to avoid with an alpha-1 blocker is an endothelin receptor antagonist like bosentan or ambrisentan. Remember that those drugs are used in the treatment of pulmonary hypertension, okay? They are vasodilators. You also want to avoid an alpha-1 blocker and minoxidil, okay? Minoxidil, the way it works is it's a potassium channel opener, okay? So it causes hyperpolarization and smooth muscle relaxation. Again, you want to avoid giving that drug with an alpha-1 blocker because it's a powerful vasodilator. Okay, but some other high yield things with minoxidil. Minoxidil is actually contraindicated in diabetics. Okay, the reasoning behind that is, remember, if you're a diabetic, you need as much insulin as you can. Okay, the thing is, insulin is released when the beta cells of your pancreas depolarize, and they depolarize by the closure of potassium channels. So if you give a drug that's a potassium channel opener, like minoxidil, okay, you basically make your beta cells of the pancreas not depolarize, okay? And if they don't depolarize, there will be less insulin release, okay? In fact, that's why minoxidil is generally contraindicated in diabetics. And the thing is, there's a drug that also sort of works like minoxidil. It's known as diazoxide. Diazoxide is a potassium channel opener, and it's actually used to treat an insulinoma, right? So an insulinoma is a tumor, classically with the MEN1 syndromes, that secretes a ton of insulin, right? So if you hyperpolarized those beta-1 cells in the pancreas, you could decrease the release of insulin, and you could potentially treat an insulinoma. Finally, with minoxidil, another thing you want to remember is that it can be used to treat a male pattern baldness. In fact, Rogaine, it's one of the, is the brand name for minoxidil. Now, another set of agents you want to avoid with the alpha-1 blockers, drugs like your prostacyclin analogs, like treprostinil, iloprost, tipoprostenol. Again, these are good vasodilators. And then finally, you also want to avoid your alpha-1 blockers with your dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? So like amlodipine, for example. And remember that those dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, they work by also, again, dilating precapillary arterioles, okay? So that's where I'm going to stop today. If you have any questions or spot any errors, feel free to make a comment to this podcast or send me an email, divineinterventionpodcast@gmail.com. And I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.